All right, I call this meeting of Lincoln County Board of Commissioners to order. We are here in the Lincoln County Courthouse. It's Wednesday, May 2nd at 9:30 a.m. And first item on our agenda is to establish a quorum. We have all three commissioners present. Next item is first of the month. We always like to recognize employees that are celebrating anniversaries of employment with the county. And we do this every 5 years on five-year multiples. And we have five people to recognize today. And I'd ask those individuals to come forward. We'll present them with a certificate and a lapel pin. And then stick around for a photo afterward. Kind of interesting, the shortest term is 10 years, and the longest term is 30 years. So we've got quite a group of experienced and much appreciated employees here today. So with that, I'll recognize each of you and present you with a certificate. Boy, I need my glasses, and I'll step off here and break a leg. All right, first, Todd Richmond, 10 years. Thank you, Todd.
Thank you very much.
All right. And next, we have Keith Cessnon. Now, Keith, we owe you an apology. We understand your formal name is Brian, but you use Keith, so we'll get you a corrected certificate.
Oh, this is fine.
No, no. We want to do it right. We want to keep you around for another 20 years. And then Richard Heffelfinger. Richard, again, thank you. And next, Roy Kenyon, 30 years, Roy.
Nice.
Thank you. Yeah, well, thank you for sticking around. And John Tompkins. John, good to see you again.
That's 110 years of public works experience standing up there. Wow. Thank you, guys. Thank you all.
It's supposed to get like we like each other.
I'm going to say, John, you've been about with the county as long as our daughters have been walking the face of the earth.
All right, guys. 3, 2, 1. Thank you.
Perfect.
Thank you all very much. Also like to note, I think this is one of the few times we've actually had all of the recipients present, so appreciate the flexibility of those department directors to let these people attend the meeting. All right, we'll move on to new hire introductions. Bridget or Dell or...
Not here yet.
They're not here yet.
They're not going to make it today.
They're not going to make it today. Well, we'll move on then to proclamations. We have three today. And the first proclamation is the Older Americans Month. I'll ask Commissioner Hall to read that proclamation. And Randy, welcome.
Good morning.
We'll let Commissioner Hall read the proclamation and share your comments.
Happy to do that. After all, in my 14 years, I have been the board's representative to the Cascades West Council of Governments, our regional provider of senior and disability services, and despite that 14-year tenure, I'm still the youngest member of this board. Come on, Commissioner Thompson, you can crack a smile. I saw you almost did. Okay, in the matter of...
Of course, yes. I'm in between both of them, literally, and then in age-wise, too.
Yeah, and in the office, too. He's the one in the middle as well. Anyway, on to...
He's supposed to treat me gentler as I get older.
True.
Okay, on to the serious business. In the matter of proclaiming May 2018 as Older Americans Month in Lincoln County. Whereas Lincoln County includes countless older Americans who enrich and strengthen our community... And whereas Lincoln County is committed to engaging and supporting older adults, their families, and caregivers, and whereas we acknowledge the importance of taking part in activities that promote physical, mental, and emotional well-being, no matter your age, and whereas Lincoln County can enrich the lives of individuals of every age by promoting home and community-based services that support independent living, involving older adults in community planning events and other activities, and providing opportunities for older adults to work, volunteer, learn, lead, and mentor. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the Lincoln County Board of Commissioners does hereby proclaim May 2018 to be Older Americans Month. We urge every resident to take time during this month to recognize older adults and the people who serve them as vital parts of our community.
Good morning, Commissioners. Thank you for having me here today. My name is Randy Moore. I'm the Director of the Senior and Disability Services Program. I just wanted to share a little information with you about our program and the things that we do to serve those older adults that are so important in our communities. One of COG's most important roles in the community is just to support older adults in staying independent, engaged, healthy, and safe in their own living environment so they can stay home as long as possible. They can be veterans, people with disabilities, or residents who need extra support or care. During this Older Americans Act month, we serve 3,500 Lincoln County residents. And through those programs, we are doing a diverse set of tools and needs to meet a diverse population's needs. These programs include options counseling, meals on wheels, transportation, volunteer opportunities, which is so important for engagement, family caregiver support, abuse prevention, and assistance with activities of daily living. The programs and services not only help strengthen and support the health of Lincoln County residents, but also the health of your community by containing costs, providing options, and coordinating care. For the first time, we were supposed to actually have a council member. We have the Oregon Disability and Service Disability and Senior Services Advisory Council's members who we've been trying to bring to represent at the commissioners' meetings. And unfortunately, my counterpart did not make it today. But the role of those councils is to support, advocate, and provide guidance on the services that we provide to your communities. So if you ever have questions or concerns about the way that we're providing services, I would encourage you to engage with council members. Doris Lamb, who is the director of Blue Heron Home Care Services, was supposed to be my counterpart today, and I will make sure that she knows how to contact you so that you, if you have any questions, you can reach out to her in the future. But bottom line, from the councils and from myself and from Oregon Cascades West Council of Government Senior Disability Services, I'd like to thank you today for adopting the Older Americans Month Proclamation for 2018.
Thank you. So, well, I guess I'm the oldest I can be first.
Absolutely. Age before beauty, in other words.
I didn't say that.
So where do you draw the line? What do you call an older American?
Well, isn't that an interesting... Yeah, that is an interesting question. So,
do you want to tell her how old you are?
I like to watch it squirm.
So for the majority of programs, like such as Medicaid, federal programs, 65 and older is what an older American is considered. But there are many programs, such as Oregon Project Independence and other Older Americans Act programs that start at 60. And then for some of our Native elders, actually 55 is the age that they consider them.
So, Social Security age is going up.
Yes.
So, does that mean you're moving the, what's an older person up?
They have not set the standard to be moved up anytime soon. So, we will see if that continues. And I would say, actually, many of the people that we serve are actually becoming some of the younger people. So.
See, guys?
Yeah. Okay, we'll have to live with that for a while. Yeah. Commissioner Hall?
An observation, and Randy, I'd appreciate it if you would validate it or disagree, but I remember, you know, when I was a newbie 14 years ago and being in conversation with the then executive director of the COG, Bill Wagner, and he was really expressing concern that the way trends seem to be going in state and federal funding, you know, basically the funding for senior services not keeping pace with the aging of our population. You know, his fear was that within a few years, we would see an evolution from the comprehensive case management the COG was able to offer to people essentially being glorified clerks, just signing up people for services they were eligible for, but not providing that really important personal case management touch. But my feeling is, partially because COG staff, COG board members, lots of other people in the state have been great advocates, and because of good innovation by the COG in bringing in some new programs like options counseling, that hasn't happened, that the personal touch is still there.
And I agree with you, Commissioner. Mm-hmm. I would say that The state standard, and unfortunately the federal standard, is going the way that Bill Wagner has had predicted. And unfortunately, I think that's going to be an ongoing issue that we're going to have to battle as time goes on. Lincoln County specifically is aging faster than the rest of Oregon's population. We are doing our best to make sure that we have caseload standards that support that one-on-one important case management and relationship building that case managers need to do. In addition, we're really working on trying to figure out other ways that we can support people with less costly programs so that the monies can go further. I think through your board participation, have heard about the fact that we're trying to figure out how we might be able to support people who could use technologies, for example, in the homes. Maybe, you know, having a Skype connection with a daughter is going to make them independent, whereas we can spend more time working with that person who doesn't have those abilities to manage that kind of technology. So, yes, but
great.
We're working very hard at keeping our caseloads as low as possible.
Great.
Okay, you brought it up. One complaint I always hear is there's too many caseloads, so I can't get my things processed fast enough. How many? You must have an average number of what caseload is for these people.
Right. So our average, Commissioner Thompson, I realized on my way here that I promised you some numbers at one point in time.
That's right.
I feel really bad that I'm sitting here in front of you without that. My problem is that in comparing caseloads across the state, and even in the county, we do operations differently. And so it's, you know, it's apples and oranges. But our case managers in Toledo manage about 90 consumers. So, and that's a combination of in-home consumers as well as consumers and facilities.
So let me ask you a few questions then. Because I think people need to realize that this isn't an instantaneous thing. If you have 90 and you visit all of them virtually, a lot of them are homebound and patients like that. So if you have 90, I mean, if you can only do three or four, maybe five at a maximum in a day, you can see what the problem is. Just getting around to visit the people to see their progress.
Right. Then you add in Highway 101 on a summer day, and I'm going from here to, you know, someplace very far north, and yes, it is definitely a problem. We do a lot of conversations on the phone. We do check in with every consumer monthly, so we do a lot of that on the phone, but their assessments are due about once a year, and so that is the majority of the time that we spend face-to-face.
The age of a lot of your patients once a year is not very frequent.
Right. Of course, they have other supports that are going into their home daily, like their home care workers who are having conversations with case managers and telling them how things are going, or facility staff.
It's a challenge.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And I've found, you know, a lot of people don't understand. I know you work very hard to be as responsive as quickly as you can, but some people have trouble that it's not, you know, like an emergency service. In other words, somebody says, well, gee, my grandmother's getting out of the hospital tomorrow and I need the Cox help and they can't get to me till next week. And unfortunately, because, you know, I try to explain to the people, because of the way the system operates and staffing levels is, that they'll respond as timelessly, but it's not an instant response service.
We work very hard, like if someone was in the hospital and needed services to get in place to get there, but the problem is the application process. You know, bureaucracy is not a slow-moving or a fast-moving machine, so even if I showed up at the hospital today, the amount of documentation that the family would have to collect and those kinds of pieces is unfortunately very cumbersome.
And then put through the system for review and approval.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I guess I would touch, if you don't mind, one more thing. One of the things you work with is to get people eligible, as if they run out of money, they have to go on to
Medicaid,
and that is a cumbersome thing to do. And you can see, if you have a care facility that needs to get paid, and a lot of people don't have the money to take it over if they don't have somebody that they're supporting. The challenge of trying to get people in to make sure they can get into Medicaid so that they can get paid. What happens? Does anybody really ever get sent out of the facility? I mean, they could have a large set of bills in that interim.
So occasionally people will be assessed that are already living in a facility that they don't meet the standard for moving or to stay in the facility. We have programs in place to try to help transition them back to the community. But unfortunately, yes, facilities sometimes end up stuck with bills. What I would say is I would encourage all of you, if you're talking to constituents who are trying to find placements and facilities, to ask them to think about being assessed before they move into facilities so that we could maybe put in place services in homes, for example, before they go to the facility, so we don't have that disconnect between facilities not getting paid and people being asked to move from a facility because they're ineligible. Unfortunately, just in October of last year, Medicaid really tightened up the standards for what makes a person eligible as far as need. And so there are a lot of people who are in facilities right now who have been eligible for years, potentially, and might not be at this point in time. And that's one of our biggest concerns, and we're trying to figure out the best safety net to help support them through those transitions.
Just may say thank you for the work you did for me, but you have a real challenge with some of these situations, and so does the care units. If you have an elderly person that can't function, can't sign their name, or can't do much for themselves, because a lot of times the family members aren't close, and just it's a real challenge that you need to go through to make this all happen.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My mother-in-law recently passed away, but my wife spent quite a bit of time providing her care and support at the end of her life, and I know she worked closely with your group to help with that process. So again, my thanks to you there. And the last thought I would offer is that we've talked a lot about, I guess, some of the challenges and the support and the services that older Americans need. But let's not forget that they do enrich, as your resolution says, enrich our communities and strengthen our communities and really add a lot to our communities. So I think that's worth noting.
Yes.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And we do have many programs that support volunteerism in the community, foster grandparents who go into schools and teach early childhood learners how to read. So, yes, I thank you for drawing us back to that
wealth of knowledge out there that is great to share.
Yes.
So, good. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Commissioners.
Mr. Chair, I move that we proclaim May as Older Americans Month in Lincoln County.
Second.
Moved and seconded. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
That motion carries. Thank you. All right, our next proclamation is Emergency Medical Services Week. Who is our presenter? We have no presenter. All right, I'll read this one, and we'll let Commissioner Hall read the next one. Proclaiming May 2026-2018 as Emergency Medical Services Week in Lincoln County, whereas emergency medical services is a vital public service, and whereas the members of emergency medical services teams are ready to provide life-saving care to those in need 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and whereas access to quality emergency care dramatically improves the survival and recovery rate of those who experience sudden illness or injury, and whereas emergency medical services has grown to fill a gap by providing important out-of-hospital care, including preventative medicine, follow-up care, and access to telemedicine, and whereas the emergency medical services system consists of first responders, emergency medical technicians, paramedics, emergency medical dispatchers, firefighters, police officers, educators, administrators, pre-hospital nurses, emergency physicians, trained members of the public, and other out-of-hospital medical care providers. And whereas the members of emergency medical services teams, whether career or volunteer, engage in thousands of hours of specialized training and continuing education to enhance their life-saving skills. And whereas it is appropriate to recognize the value and the accomplishments of emergency medical services providers by designating Emergency Medical Services Week. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the Lincoln County Board of Commissioners does hereby proclaim the week of May 20 to 26, 2018, as Emergency Medical Services Week with the theme EMS Strong, Stronger Together. We encourage the community to observe this week with appropriate programs, ceremonies, and activities. All right. Does any comments or... With no one here to address us, I'll entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I would move we proclaim Emergency Medical Services Week.
Second.
Moved and seconded. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. That motion carries. And again, we're happy to proclaim the great services that they provide to our citizens.
Okay.
Moving on to our third proclamation. Ladies and gentlemen, if there are any, looks like ladies. This is Missing Murdered Indigenous Women's Day, and I believe our presenters Kim Lane and a group of others come forward, and I'll let Commissioner Hall read the proclamation.
Okay. Proclaiming May 5th as Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women's Day in Lincoln County. Whereas Lincoln County, Oregon stands with other tribal, regional, state, and national governments and organizations in support of National Day of Awareness for Missing and Murdered Native Women and Girls, and whereas violent crimes against Native women are underrepresented in national statistics and the collective discussion around violence against women, a fact that is rooted in oppression, historical, and generational trauma, and whereas the disappearances and murders of Native women are often overlooked and underreported and are often connected to domestic violence, sexual assault, or trafficking. And now, therefore, be it resolved, the Lincoln County Board of Commissioners, in an effort to support the visibility of this issue nationally, do hereby proclaim May 5th, 2018, as Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women's Day to dedicate, acknowledge, and honor those affected by violent crimes against Indigenous women publicly.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Hi. Yeah, go ahead and share your comments.
So I'm Kim Lane. I'm a tribal member and the program coordinator for the CARE program. We give direct services to victims of domestic and sexual violence out in Siletz. And I have with me today...
My name is Delina John. I serve as a sexual assault advocate for the CARE program.
And I'm Heather Butler, and I'm the domestic violence advocate.
We thank you guys for hearing us today and having us, you know, be a part of your meeting.
Happy to do so.
Basically, we're here because this is a issue that's, like the proclamation says, very underrepresented in the national, you know, collective discussion. And Oregon is in one of the top five states where the proportion of murder victims for Natives is larger than the per capita proportion for citizens. So there are more, there's a higher percentage of murder rates for Natives in that field than there are Natives versus non-Natives in the population. So that ratio is just really skewed. And so being one of those states and knowing that up in Portland we have a large population of Natives, here in Siletz we have a large population of Natives, is definitely something that we all need to take notice of, because we know that we have issues here in Lincoln County with interpersonal violence. We know that it's connected to issues around drugs. And I think that we've done such a good job about addressing those issues in other fields. You guys have seen us at Domestic Violence Awareness Month, at Sexual Assault Awareness Month, that we definitely need to add this to the discussion. So that's why we're here today. And, you know, it's definitely something that's just getting started. And we're happy to have you guys be a part of that.
Mr. Chair, these numbers are staggering. I mean, I was aware that there was a disparity, but not this kind of disparity. Can you expand a little bit more on what the belief is, what is the cause of this horrific, this horrific fact?
You know, I'd say it's tied to three things. It's directly tied to domestic violence, sexual assault, and it's also tied to racism. It's oppression in its truest form. Native people are left out of the collective discussion a lot, sometimes intentionally, sometimes not intentionally. And there's terms like the missing. So there's a lot of people who aren't even reported missing. There's a lot of people who are considered the less dead. So if you're a sex worker, if you're a person of color, if you have a marginalized identity, it's viewed that in a lot of areas, your death, your victimization is less than of value of others. So
is it like a lack of police and other authorities taking these cases as seriously as they might with a white victim, do you think?
I think that's an issue. I also think that Natives tend to be in rural populations. Rural communities often don't have a lot of great resources. It's harder to notice if someone goes missing, especially if maybe... We also don't have a database that tracks missing and murdered Indigenous women, and so not having a database, there's nowhere to input that.
So that brings up the question. Last night we were in Siletz, and we were talking about the law enforcement district that was created out there, and it's a collaboration between the tribe and the county. I guess I'd like to have you all answer the question. Do you feel safer today there with having the law enforcement district in the... working together with the county and the Siletz tribe on your kind of issues?
I can speak to being a tribal member and living in tribal, on tribal property and tribal land and tribal housing. And now compared to, say, a year and a half ago, I would have to agree that having their presence has done a big change for our community. So, yes.
Positive change. Mm-hmm. Okay, good.
In particular, Martin Bennett, having him be a part of the county's force, he's done a great job of doing outreach to the tribe and working with victims of interpersonal violence.
So I guess I'm going to ask the question that we should be asking. Are we the only one that's done this kind of thing in the United States where the county and the tribe works together on law enforcement? I think there's other places that do it, but I've never heard it talked
about. Doesn't like the Grand Ronde, they fund expanded presence by the Polk County Sheriffs.
Yeah. They have tribal police as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. But they do have tribal police. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay. So it is.
Well, every tribe's different.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We're a PL 280 state. So, you know.
And what's that mean?
Public law 280. So we, the way we govern our jurisdictions and stuff, that's guided by that. But tribes across the nation, we aren't unified in how we address things, and that's the beautiful part about tribes, is we all govern a different way. Our partnership has definitely been beneficial to the people of Siletz. It's definitely been beneficial to this program. And, you know, I think that this is kind of our next topic that we move towards, because we all know that, I think we can think of famous cases, the Disney case, where she went missing decades ago.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We've had tribal members whose parents have been murdered or who have just gone missing. And that's, I don't think, necessarily a lack of this county or the police force, but it's just something that happens. And, you know, tribes across the nation have been stepping up because everything is so different in each tribe. Some of them don't have a police force. Some of them don't have a relationship with the county. Some of them live in areas where the police force is out and out racist towards the reservation population. So we're really lucky to have this relationship, and we're lucky to have mutuality here.
My only question would be to the sheriff, if you don't mind. Sheriff, could you just answer the question? So, when you report these kind of cases, do you track by nationality? Because they say they don't have a database, but you may be reacting out there and be able to already have a database that's available.
There are a certain number of cases that we actually, in our partnership with the tribe, that we have to report for our federal on the federal level that they're required to, and so we pull those numbers out through our records department and give them to the tribe each year. So we've been working on kind of making those numbers to where we can easily bring those out of the system. So, yeah, there is a certain number that we do, and it's in part of our agreement with how the funding comes to us through the tribe. It's part of what they need to report also, so we are keeping track of it. But I think it's also, you know, this is great hearing this. I'm glad I was here today to have this, because, it really goes to what we're trying to do out there in that community. And when we initially started the agreement with the tribe and the city, we had an all-patrol meeting, and one piece of that all-patrol meeting was having someone from the tribe come in and do cultural awareness of the Siletz tribe. And it was so important to have that there and hear the deputies really listen to what that is. Because, you know, they treat everyone out there like just anybody else. But, you know, I think that because of the history and, you know, some of what's going on in other parts of the country, you know, I think sometimes things go underreported because of the community, I may be wrong, but you know, don't come out and report at things that they should be reporting to us. And we don't want that relationship at all. We want to make sure things are getting reported as accurately as possible with what's happening, because that's the only way we can do our work better out there. So that's one thing I would stress, is just, you know, to the group is hopefully that things are getting reported when this happens. But I know that there's a large percentage that it just flat isn't getting reported too.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly I'd like to recognize the great relationship that the county has with the tribe. And certainly I think it's nice to hear that the law enforcement efforts seem to have a positive effect. And hopefully through this proclamation, through this process today, we've helped create greater awareness of this serious issue. And the last observation, I believe, Heather, you're the domestic violence victims advocate that the county hired about a year ago, and certainly, obviously, recognition of the seriousness of this issue. So, again, appreciate your comments. Hopefully, we've helped create greater awareness. And Commissioner Hall.
In our packet, there's an information sheet about an event. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
This Saturday.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So thank you. So like we said, while our relationship is great here, this is a national issue.
Yes. Yes.
And that's why we're so lucky to have what we have here. And so what the children have done, this is actually kind of their project that they came up and it just happened to come up with what happened in Portland, because they did a proclamation up in Portland with the national leader of the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women's Project. And what that is the kids are going to be going out. They're going to be tying ribbons to the fences of their schools. Our Native girls are wearing red dresses, which is a traditional way to show your support of crime victims, specifically Native women. We've been doing the Red Shawl Project. You'll see today that all the CARE program members have their shawls out. We've been inviting the community to come out and work on those, so that there will be an honor dance at the powwow that will be happening this summer. And this Saturday, the kids will be doing cedar ties. They'll be praying. They have T-shirts. And so they're just raising awareness. And that's really what we're asking of the rest of the county, is we're trying to lift this discussion up on a pedestal so that those communities that aren't as lucky as us, for those people who even in our community may still harbor some of that oppression within them and those feelings of fear to go report, to speak out about things, that opens the doorway for them. And so it's just the beginnings of awareness, and we hope that spreads so that next year it's bigger, and maybe we're not talking about just awareness, but like, what do we do to continue to be that community that's a step ahead?
Mm-hmm. Glad to help you with this important work.
Thank you.
I'll move that we proclaim May 5th as Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women's Day in Lincoln County.
Thank you.
Moved and seconded. All those in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Motion carries. Thank you.
And I would like to say, Officer, Brewster with the Sheriff's Department, he is very active in our community. He comes out to our CEDAR meetings monthly. And that's just,
thank you.
Pass it that along.
Well,
thanks
so
thank
much.
You.
The sheriff, I'm sure, heard those words and will share them with him.
Yeah.
So, thank you all very much. All right, the next item on our agenda is the adoption of the consent calendar. These are items of a routine nature, items that have come before the board before. I'll entertain a motion or any highlights or comments that commissioners or staff may wish to
make. I'll
second.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Motion carries. Moving on, we have a decision action item on the rate schedule for North Lincoln Sanitary Service in the North County. This was an information item that was presented to the board last week. And I don't know if commissioners have any comments. Otherwise, I believe we're ready for a decision.
Well, we walked through it pretty thoroughly last week. I'd be glad to make a motion to approve the proposed new rate schedule for North Lincoln Sanitary Service for the unincorporated areas of North County.
Second. Moved and seconded. All those in favor say aye.
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 That motion carries. Moving along, we're to reports, elected officials, department directors, and we have a presentation on Health and Human Services update by our interim director, Rebecca Austin. Welcome, Rebecca.
Thank you.
Good to see you.
Thanks. It's nice to be here. So I just want to remind you that there are three divisions in the Health and Human Services. There's the behavioral health, the primary care, and public health. And I think I'll just give you a quick brief update on primary care and public health before we get into the behavioral health status. So I wanted you all to know that the primary care had their HRSA site visit last week. And maybe 2 weeks ago now. And they passed with flying colors. They had two conditions, both very minor. One was related to, we have to go to a screening all clinical staff for every 2 years. We are just doing it initially when they're hired. So we'll be changing our policy on that. And the other one is that we make sure that we're documenting that we don't exceed a salary limit that HRSA has set. And we don't exceed that, but we don't have it well documented. So we'll fix that. So out of almost 200 things that they look at, I think that's really outstanding. So we provide a really good service there. And it's for the whole FQHC, actually. I shouldn't say it's just primary care. But they do focus heavily on our primary care practice.
So, Rebecca, before you move on from that, can I ask, just then by passing this, this means our HRSA grant to operate the FQHC continues, is it for 3 more years?
It's every 18 months.
Oh, okay.
This was our 18-month site visit, okay. And then I believe next year we have to submit the grant. So this just tells them that we're doing what we're supposed to be doing with the grant money so that they don't cut us. So right. I guess if you get so many conditions, then they start cutting your funding. So and you don't have to worry about that.
That grant, is it still $650,000 a year?
No, it's quite a bit more than that.
It's gone up.
I want to say $1.2 million now. Yeah.
Per year?
Yes.
Wow. So basically that and the client reimbursement is the backbone of how the FQHC operates.
Exactly. And, you know, the history for FQHCs and the reason why we get this grant is because we serve everybody, regardless of whether they have insurance or they're underinsured. Mm-hmm. So that money is to help us kind of run the operation, because you can imagine if you can't bill for your service, then you're not going to stay in business for very long.
Yeah. Commissioner Thompson. Rebecca, the underinsured and the client part of this money, mm-hmm. do you have a rough number of how much money that adds into your budget? Then you got $1.2 million from the grant. Then how much do you actually, is the total of those two items? Have to know offhand.
I'm not sure what the question is.
Well, you get reimbursed.
Yes, we do.
The two major parts are your mm-hmm. client reimbursement and the grant. But so how much?
How much is our total budget, you mean?
Well, either way you do, I can back out the grant money, or you can just give me what the client reimbursement total might be.
I see what you're asking. You know, I don't have that number at the tip of my tongue.
Okay.
I could probably give
a lot of budgets, and I can't remember every number.
Yeah, it was a long time that we worked on the primary care budget, too. So I would not want to pull a number out of my hat. I can definitely get that for you, though.
Well, it's just one of those things. I'm curious how big it has grown from what it was when it started. It's
yeah.
grown quite a bit.
Yeah, it has grown a lot. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the fact on that, and if you don't mind if I jump in again, the fact that, I mean, when we opened the FQHC, I think the county uninsured rate was something like 16%, and thanks to the Affordable Care Act and Oregon being a Medicaid expansion state, it's down to 4%, which is really good in one aspect, that it helps get more people in the door, but that means there's still some uninsured folks presumably we're serving, and also, isn't it, you know, as a general rule, Medicaid reimbursement rates seldom, if ever, cover the full cost of providing a service. So
exactly.
That HRSA grant helps backfill some of the gap between the Medicaid reimbursement and the actual cost of the
right.
service.
That's right. Medicaid and Medicare both pay us a set amount, but it doesn't cover our costs. Right.
Right.
Yep.
So one of the things I worry about is the relationship with the hospital. We have to mesh together here to make this thing successful.
Yes.
Since you're the director, how do we go about doing it, and are we doing it now or are we starting to improve in doing it?
We are we're doing it, and we're improving it. So the directors all met with the CEO of the hospital, Dr. Leslie Ogden, a couple weeks ago now, and talked about some of the rough spots. So we're trying to build up that relationship, and we really all want to do the same thing. You know, we want to provide the best quality care we can in the county. So we're working better together, and we each have the same similar electronic health record system, so it's getting easier to be able to know what each other of us are doing for our clients so that we can provide that good quality care.
So I guess I'm going to expand, since we just had tribal members here, but they also have a health facility that sees people. Are mm-hmm. we meshing in with them also?
Of course, yes. They're very good partners of ours, actually. And I think we're expanding that beyond the primary care. Now public health is doing some programs with the tribe. And, I think we have good working relationships with the tribal clinic.
I mean, that's our ultimate goal, is that all citizens get good, adequate care.
Absolutely.
And we have three different, actually several other smaller components, but three major components that we need to be working with if we're going to be successful at this.
Commissioner Thompson, could I say something in response to your question to Rebecca about the relationship with Samaritan? Just from my standpoint as a member of the Samaritan CCO Board of Directors, and then also Steve Sparks is here, our consultant on the Stepping Up Project, and Steve and I have had a lot of interactions with the folks at Samaritan, and the message I've been getting, especially this year, is that Samaritan finds Lincoln County much more open and eager to have a positive, collaborative working relationship, and they're really appreciative of the direction things are going.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, you're welcome.
I'd like to add a couple of things. First of all, I have met one-on-one with Dr. Ogden and talked about how the county can work the county and the hospitals can work together better to be collaborative in our efforts to address health care of our citizens. And certainly, if the more people we have involved in this issue, the better. So I think there's great progress being made, and look forward to continued improvements. Last observation I'd make is, if we only had two conditions out of 200, that's about a 99% passing grade, which I think in most schools would be an A+.
I would say so.
So
yes.
Good work.
Yes, thank you. So let me just update you quick on public health. It's 2 weeks. 2 weeks from now will be our accreditation site visit. So, you know, since I got here, almost 5 years now, we have been working towards getting our health department accredited, so meeting some national standards. And we are now finally going to have our site visit, so it'll be very much like HRSA coming on board and kind of going over, and they're coming on the 17th and 18th of May. And some of you will probably be involved in that.
It's on my calendar.
They'll be wanting to meet with our
10:30 Friday
with our governing board. Great.
I think mine is 20 minutes later.
Uh huh.
So we're not meeting together.
That's right. So we're really looking forward to that. It's been a lot of work for the last 5 years, but I really feel like it's the work that we needed to do to get our health department up to meet the standards. So we're excited about that. So I wanted to let you know about that. Farmer market vouchers will be coming out through our WIC program. And we have...
Explain what that is.
The farmer market voucher?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's vouchers that we give to our WIC clients
WIC
so that they can... WIC clients are...
Women, infants.
Women, infants, and children. Children under five. And pregnant women also. So they come and they get some supplemental food benefits that they can use at our local grocery stores to supplement their food to make sure that they have enough to eat. It's been a very long-standing program run through the USDA. And they have put out these vouchers that we can hand out to all our members that they can go and redeem for fresh fruits and vegetables at our local farmer markets. So they're very popular, and we do some signing people up right at the farmer's market, and then we also do some education about how they can the best way to shop for the foods to get their best deals, and then how to prepare those foods too. So it's a really exciting thing because we all know eating more fresh fruits and vegetables will help our health. So, and to go along with that, we've also launched our Veggie RX program, which is also to encourage families to eat more fresh fruits and vegetables. So at every high school, we have stocked some refrigerators full of fresh fruits and vegetables in collaboration with FoodShare. And we send backpacks home with kids that need fresh fruits and vegetables. So it's a great collaborative effort between public health, FoodShare, and our school-based health centers. And the schools, actually, because they needed to find room for us to put the food. So that we're pretty excited about that because you know from the community health assessment that we have a very high rate, about almost 30% of our families in Lincoln County have food insecurity, which means that they don't exactly know when their next where their next meal is coming from. So this has been a great collaborative effort with public health and FoodShare, and we're really excited about that. So that's been launched, so you might be hearing some information more about that. I wanted to say that we've brought on another family nurse practitioner for our primary care. She's going to be full-time, which we're very excited about. She has brings some great experience to our adolescents, so she's going to be doing a lot of work in our school-based health centers. And she's ours. She's all ours. She's not a locum, so she's not going to leave. She's looking for a house, so we're excited about having her. And then I don't know if you heard that we also hired an MD for our primary care, Dr. Hickthier. And so she just bought a house in Lincoln County, so we're pretty excited that she's here to stay, too. So she's ours as well. We have a contract with her. So.
And just for clarity, a locums is somebody that's under contract versus an employee of the county.
They're under contract through a company, usually, that does that business, and they're very short-term.
So we've got a permanent.
We have two permanent providers now, which is exciting.
And these have been positions that have been vacant for a long time.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Or only filled by locums.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good point. Yeah.
So now, if I can, I'll just update you on our behavioral health, our last issue, and sort of our hot button topic right now. So I think you've heard that we had a budget shortfall when we were trying to balance our budget for the 18-19 fiscal year. And that came as quite a surprise to many of us. We weren't expecting that. And I think really a lot of people want to know how did this happen. And I think it was just sort of a perfect storm where we had a decrease in revenue and an increase in our personnel costs. And we were mainly increasing our personnel so that we could meet the needs of our community. And so it wasn't, of course, anything intentional or intended, but I'm really grateful that we caught it when we did, because we have sort of set some goals for ourselves now to right-size that department to make sure that we can still meet the needs of the community and be as efficient as possible. And to try to make the program sustainable from here on out. So we are having to lay off 8 people to go along with our goal of right-sizing. So I try to look at it as more trimming. It's very painful for the employees that are being affected by this layoff. Many of them have just come to us, so it's quite an awkward situation, actually. But we really tried to focus on paring back, sort of trimming a little bit where we would feel it the least in the community. And that is through our what they call our co-occurring disorder program, which means that the client has underlying mental health issues along with an addictions issue. And this is evidence-based practice. We were quite excited about getting this program on board, but I think we underestimated how long it would take us to get people in and engaged in these services. So we have more counselors than we have clients, so that's an area that we can trim back the counselors and still provide service. And I think one of our goals is to try to provide that service across all of our mental health services. So everybody, so that one door fits all, kind of, you know, that everybody has that breadth of knowledge in their counseling skills, that they can provide services to these co-occurring individuals across our program instead of just making it a little program unto itself. So that's kind of a long-term goal that we're aiming for. But we will have two counselors left in that program, and then two others that have been trained in the co-occurring. So I don't think we're going to be turning anybody away. I'm pretty sure that we can divvy up the caseloads from the people that will be laid off. So we won't be decreasing services to our community. So that's in process right now, actually. All the staff have been notified who are going to be laid off. You know, per the contract, there are bumping rights for people that have seniority. So we're in that process right now of deciding who can bump who. And so it's very stressful for the staff and very challenging for the managers to handle, actually. So, and then getting staff, you know, sort of reshuffling caseloads so that staff have larger caseloads is also a big adjustment that we're going to be going through in the next month. And the layoffs will be effective June 1st. And then for the sustainability piece, that's another goal that I'm working on very hard because it's something that I have experience in with the public health. Public health financing is very complex, and I thought it was the most complex until I became familiar with behavioral health funding. And that's even more complex. And the state has a lot of things they want us to do, but they don't really provide the money for us to do it. So I'm trying to figure out how that works. I'm learning. I have a degree in business administration. It's my first degree that I got many years ago, so this isn't an area that I'm wilting from. I kind of like this part of it. So I'm definitely trying to figure it out, having lots of conversations with the state. You want us to do this, but you only give me this much money. How am I supposed to do it? Kind of conversations. And so you'll probably be hearing more from me about that as I learn and really try to. I feel like we made public health sustainable. We can make behavioral health sustainable as well. And that's really my goal. And then I think our last goal is that we deliver services in the most efficient manner that we can in Lincoln County. And I think we can do that. We have some awesome people working in our behavioral health program. And we're going to flourish. You know, I really feel that. And this is a painful time and a challenging time for us right now. But I feel very confident that we can get where we have to go.
Questions?
Yes, ma'am, Mr. Chair. Rebecca, thanks for being here, and thanks for sharing. And I know this is a difficult time for you and for all of your team. And as you're aware, you know, a lot of questions are coming to me and I'm sure to my fellow commissioners. And I don't know how to what degree you can address them, but do you have a sense of why this financial shortfall didn't come to light any sooner than it did?
I don't.
Yeah. Because I know you've just taken over as acting department director relatively recently.
Yeah,
I think. But it seems like something we should have caught sooner.
I would hope we would have caught it sooner, but it didn't happen, and I can't tell you, Bill, why it didn't happen.
Yeah, I don't know if that's something we can answer at some point, just to keep if a similar situation is ever developing. You know, we are updating our finance software, and maybe, you know, if we have the tools to, if something like this develops in the future. Hopefully it won't, but you know, that might be something that would be useful.
Well, I'll offer a comment. I think when we appointed a new interim director, as part of what you might expect a new director to do, you are going to review budgets and determine where you're at within those budgets.
Yep.
And part of that process identified this problem. And that's when we acted to address it rather than to allow it to worsen, which would have only required greater cuts to fill
exactly.
a deeper deficit.
Yeah, and I think the budgets were held quite tightly by a few individuals in the organization, and it wasn't as widespread to the managers and the division directors as it should have been. And we've been trying to make that correction for a while, and so
now that's going to happen.
Yes, definitely. In fact, finance is starting to make appointments with all managers to set up templates for them to be able to more easily access their budgets and in-code. So that's happening right now.
So you've already changed some policies, procedures within the department to address this.
Absolutely.
I'm very glad to hear that.
So you used the words downsizing. Mm-hmm. We downsize.
No, I didn't say downsize. I said right size.
Okay, I didn't say maybe downsize. Maybe I misunderstood.
Uh-huh.
Right size. You know, we went through a similar situation when we ran financial problems a few years ago, and it was tough. But I use the word right sizing. That's a word I like better than downsizing.
Yes.
Because right sizing means that you plan on recovering and coming back out of it. Is that correct? What's your feeling for what can be done? We felt like we could do it, but we had to correct the budget down so that we stayed healthy so we could make the recovery faster.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's what we tried to do during the budget process, is really look at the programs that we wanted to leave harmless, such as our crisis program. We're just building that up, and I think we all know how important that work is. So we didn't want to harm that program. and we have funding for that program, so we wanted to keep that intact and really look at the programs that we could trim back and not harm ourselves. So, yeah, I think we really need to look at the data to see what the communities need, to do a needs assessment to make sure that we're filling the needs that the community has. And I don't think we've done that as thoroughly as we could. So, and working with the state to figure out where the funding is, what it's going to support, what it's not going to support, how we can fill those gaps, and working with the CCO to maybe pilot some innovative ideas that will get us further down the road in providing the best quality care that we can for our community. So I don't know if I totally answered your question, but
you did.
I don't feel like, you know, we're going down, you know. I just feel like we're sort of trimming the sails a little bit and taking a little bit of a new course. We're not going to do anything drastic, and I don't think the community will even really notice, other than hopefully access to services will be better, our staff will be happier, they'll be more productive, they'll be, you know, what one thing I'm learning about behavioral health staff is they really want to help these people that are in trouble, you know, and so we need to bring those clients in, and we need to get them seen, and we need to get them back out into the community so they can be, you know, functioning and, you know, healthy.
Well, I'm like any of these things, reimbursement rates and where it's coming from is always a challenge, and state funding is a part of it, federal funding is a part of it, and sometimes we can get, we can support you by being able to do a better job in Salem and making sure that the programs are better funded, because it's one of those areas that oftentimes gets trimmed and a lot of people don't realize the consequences.
Right, and I know that the Association of Counties has a very active mental health committee, and Barbara Terrell, who is the division director for behavioral health, and myself are both trying to get to those meetings and learn as much as we can so we can come back to you and say, this is what's going on in the legislature. Can you help us out here? So
we'll, got a little experience in that area.
We'll keep you apprised. Yeah.
Commissioner Hall.
I know it's probably going to be small comfort to the folks who are losing their positions and others impacted by this, but I have heard, I haven't been able to verify, that we're not alone in dealing with this, that Linn County, I don't know if you've heard this is also having to downsize. I see nods from Barbara Terrell. They're having to downsize their behavioral health program as well.
Exactly.
Because of the reduced reimbursement rates. Another question that's come up, and I'd like to comment and just see if you agree or disagree on this. People will say, well, the county has reserves. Why don't you use your reserves to plug this gap? But the problem is, until or if ever the client base would come along to support these positions, you really can't use reserves to sustain positions like this on a continuing basis, can you?
Well, one of the first things we did in trying to balance the budget was to do the simple thing. So we did have a little pot of money that we applied to the deficit, mm-hmm. and then we cut all of our vacancies except for our crisis manager. And that still didn't balance the budget, so we had to, dig a little bit deeper. And so that's how the layoffs came about. But I totally agree that we can't keep relying on reserves. That's the sustainable part that I'm really trying to get us to, because it's not sustainable for us to use up reserves. And then what do we do the next year, and the next year? So I think that's where the right sizing and the sustainability come in. They play off of each other. That we have to get to the right size that we can support financially with the money that we get. And it has to be sustainable over a long period of time, because the one thing I did when I came into this role is I want us to be stable. I want people to be able to count on our services and that we're meeting the needs of the community. That's the most important thing to me. So I think that's necessary. We have to be good stewards of the tax dollars, and we can't just keep relying on taking money from Peter to pay Paul or whatever they say. I don't like that idea, and I think we can do better. I do.
And then there's a perception gap, I think, fair or not, but, as I monitor Facebook and participate in some Facebook discussions about this since the front page story appeared in the News Times last Friday, when I made the statement that these counselors were not seeing a sufficient client load to essentially sustain their positions, more than one person chimed in with, well, I or my friend or my relative or people working in social services tried to get into see Lincoln County Behavioral Health and was told that they were booked out weeks in advance. So how could that be? And I don't know if they're, without knowing the individual circumstances of those folks, if you can really definitively answer that, but that does seem to be a widespread perception that's out there.
Yes, and I do think that we have had some barriers, and they're sort of holdovers from a time where we didn't have enough counselors to provide the services. And so now we are working very diligently now to remove some of those barriers and get people seen quicker. It's a little bit of a dance, mm-hmm. that we do, and that's part of the right sizing. Like, who is out there that wants to be seen, and how are we providing that service? So we're really taking a close look at that, taking down some of the barriers. They're working right now very hard on that process, because they are recognizing that we haven't made that adjustment soon enough. Because we're bringing people on, and when you bring people on, there's a training period. They have to get to know this very complicated electronic health record system. It takes, months, really, to be able to be independent in that system. And so, we're bringing people on, we're getting them trained up, and then we start loading them up with clients. So we're just kind of at that point now, especially with our adult mental health services. So just the community has to be patient a little bit, and I know the whole layoff thing has kind of blown that up for everybody to see. Normally that would be a very internal process that we'd be working on, but it has become very public, and so I would just ask the community to be patient with us, that we are working on that, and efficiency is one of our goals.
Thanks. And a little bit of historical context I think that's important. Mr. Belmont shared with me the other day you were doing some research in Lincoln County Health and Human Services. Total employment in 2009, if I remember, you told me, was something like 108.
It was 11 and 12. I think it was 100 you know, plus or minus FTE.
And now it's like 157, so I mean, yeah, it is...
We've had some pretty expansive growth in the whole... That's all of Health and Human Services, yeah, in those, right, services over the last 7 years.
And that's mainly been driven by ACA expansion and Medicaid expansion. I think it's been a big part of that, but...
Yes, definitely.
You know, unfortunately, sometimes with rapid growth come challenges.
Absolutely.
And this could be an outgrowth of that.
Absolutely.
So I have some questions, and I think one of the perceptions out there, and rightfully so, is we're saying that we're reducing the staffing in the co-occurrence area, and yet there's a waiting list to see counselors. Correct me if I'm wrong, but the waiting list to see counselors are in other areas of behavioral,
right,
health. There are six or seven different other programs,
right,
that there has been a waiting list, and that's been a concern of mine. I know you and I have discussed it, and we are working on ways to improve the access and response time, if you will, to those individuals that are seeking those services. But the reality is, getting back to caseloads, when you look at caseloads for the co-occurrence counselors, there really hasn't been a caseload to support the number of counselors that were on staff.
Right, right.
And so, to clarify that a little bit, you heard one of our prior speakers talk about caseloads in senior and disability services being 90 per individual.
Yeah.
What would be a reasonable caseload for a co-occurrence counselor, and what have they been?
Well, I know that when I talked to staff the other day, they thought somewhere between 50 and 70 would be reasonable.
Now that's a caseload.
That's
not
a caseload.
The number of people that are supposed to be seen daily.
No. That's a big difference. This is a caseload. So these are people that come to them when they need to.
Right.
I don't even know what the frequency is. I think it depends on what stage they are in their recovery.
50, 60 would be a reasonable caseload?
Right.
And what have they been?
Well, I don't have all that information for you. It's been it varies, though. Somewhere between 25... Oh, does Barbara have that?
Yes. The caseloads have varied with co-occurring 25 at the lowest to 60. And so it's important to understand that the co-occurring program included counselors who were mental health counselors who then got trained in addictions and problem gambling. And so someone who is in that role of a licensed counselor can see and provide addiction services or problem gambling services in addition to mental health. So we had some folks who were just in this CODA program, and we had folks who were in the adult mental health program up in Lincoln City, and some of those folks saw everybody, whoever came in. One person with the lowest caseload was seeing families specifically, and historically involving families in addictions work, mental health and addictions work specifically, has been a tough sell. And so she was a mental health counselor and then was pulled into this other program, and it's taken a long time for her caseload to get built up.
So, again, my questions on caseloads, though, have to do with the fact that, you know, why don't we use reserves? Well, if we have sufficient caseloads, we're reimbursed by the state, and that reimbursements would then support additional counselors in the co-occurrence area.
Right.
And I think it's important to then say, you know, is it an efficient use of taxpayer dollars to fund a program that could be funded with other taxpayer dollars from the state versus our county taxpayer dollars when there, at this time, isn't the demand for those services? Having said that, as the demand for those services increase and as we get greater reimbursement from the state, we'll be able to hire additional counselors in this area. So we're not going to use reserves to fill a need when really there isn't the need been established. I'm not saying it's not there,
mm-hmm,
but I'm saying it, we haven't established it. Plus, there are other partners in the county that can provide some of these support services. So using reserves really isn't in the best interest of the county financial or really the citizens and their taxpayer dollars.
Right, right.
Okay, any other questions or comments?
No. Thank you for coming, and
sure.
Thank you.
You're
for
welcome.
Thank you.
Fielding some tough questions.
Yeah,
appreciate
welcome.
The update.
Yeah.
All right, next item would be commissioner reports.
Mr. Chair,
please.
I'm pleased to announce that I received word on Monday that Governor Kate Kate Brown has submitted my name to the Oregon Senate for appointment to the Housing Stability Council. This is the state's chief advisory body on housing policy issues. There was a state housing council for many years, plus a poverty council, several other advisory committees, and about, I believe, 3 or 4 years ago, the legislature combined those into a single housing stability council. So I have my confirmation hearing before the Senate Rules Committee on May 22nd. If I'm appointed, I will be the only coastal member on the council and the only local elected representative. So I appreciate this further opportunity to advocate for the needs of county, coastal residents especially, but all Oregonians in the area of developing housing policy.
Very good news. Commissioner Thompson.
So I went down to Coos Bay back on the 26th and to the OPAC, Ocean Policy Advisory Committee, and we discussed Territorial Sea Plan Part 5, which I'm going to let Wayne talk a little more about, but Rocky Shores, Charlie Pliabong has been working on that, and that's another section. It's Part 3 of the Territorial Sea Plan. We talked about ocean acidification and the council that's been formed. I've got updates on that. We talked about PMAC, and PMAC is a particularly interesting one for us because it's the wave energy test site that's out here, and we actually had plans and drawings, which I have with me, but of the facilities, proposed routes, and all the, they've got more detail now about how they're going to do it, particularly on the shoreside system. There'll be a manhole, and then there'll be a line that comes up the beach, and there'll be go to a small block facility where they can convert the power to the power that can fit into the grid. Just because you generate power doesn't mean it fits into the grid. And so they have to do the conversion, which is an area that has been done before, but we don't know exactly when each device will be there, so you have to be able to make conversions for the different types of devices. So that was an interesting way. Also talked about the oil and gas leasing in the Outer Continental Shelf that the president. So we had a lot of conversations, but the biggest, most important one, I think, for the county, all these are important, but because of the lawsuit, I'll let Wayne do a little bit of discussion about David Yamamoto, and he gave a very good presentation down there. And so did David Allen.
So a little bit of history about this. Again, we're talking about the amendments to the Territorial Sea Plan, Part 5 around wave energy. And as you recall, the county participated on behalf really of all the coastal counties, the six coastal counties, then Lincoln County on top of that, with a friend of the court brief that challenged the Department of Land Conservation and Development's recommendation to the Land Conservation and Development Commission, LCDC's, adoption of the amendments. Those amendments differed from the recommendations that came from the Ocean Policy Advisory Committee, and we were concerned about that. And David Allen, representing a couple of petitioners, filed a challenge to that particular action. We joined in. And the end result was the court agreed that the process used by LCDC was wrong and invalidated the amendment to the plan and sent that back to LCDC. We followed that up. We had this discussion with kind of the next step. So that has occurred. What do we do next? And we crafted a letter. David Allen crafted a letter. We brought on and, again, got all the coastal counties. This is pretty important. All the coastal counties joining in with us in a letter to the Assistant Attorney General who represented the state in that matter to go to LCDC and DLCD to say, the next step should be go back to the original OPAC recommendations and adopt those. If you want to resolve this issue, adopt those. That letter was presented to the state and then presented to OPAC, forwarded to OPAC. And as Commissioner Thompson indicated, David Yamamoto and then the Assistant Attorney General presented this matter to OPAC at their meeting last week and to see what OPAC would do. And what OPAC ended up doing was passing on a motion, a letter that goes to DLCD and to the commission that says exactly that. Adopt the recommendations, the original recommendations from OPEC. And that is being crafted for the chair of OPEC to sign and to send on to the state. And so we're continuing to monitor the situation. Now we'll see what the state does with this. They have a meeting coming up at the end of, towards the end of May. Their agenda is out for that meeting, and currently this matter is not on the agenda, but in part that may be due to the fact that the appellate judgment, there are some procedural things that have to go through for the appellate judgment to be finalized. And I know that David Allen and the attorneys for the state have now agreed that, that this is done. There's not going to be any further appeals, and it just needs to go through that process to get the appellate judgment finalized. Letters have been sent to that effect to the courts, and hopefully that will be done maybe within the next week or so. We don't know how long it actually takes, but once that's done, then the commission can take up this matter and see what the next steps are. I think there will be a presence of OPEC members and other interested parties at the next meeting of the commission to see if this is ripe for consideration. And if so, then we'll see where this goes.
So let me expand a little bit.
Sure.
Because a lot of people don't understand why this is so important that we're fighting so hard about it. But I think the comment made by the governor's staff member that was there was very significant when he said, you know, I deal with these different kinds of advisory councils all the time. He says, this case makes me reflect on the importance of these advisory councils, and I'm going to take a different approach into the future. Because an advisory council can be brushed off a lot of times by agencies. And under this court case, if you can imagine how many advisory councils, these types of councils there are, it makes it so that it's important so that the agency can't just roll over the public. And that's my description of what he said. And I'll let David Allen's going to come up under public comment and make comments. But if you think about it, it's not just about this case, which is important, but it reflects on all of the councils in the state that if an agency has to take its comments seriously, that we actually improve the importance of the public comments that are made to the state agencies.
That's a good reflection.
So, I could go on and on about all these subjects, but I did what I could in a short period of time, and I think David Allen probably add a little bit more to this too.
All right, I'm going to use, I'm going to use a prerogative of the chair and ask the sheriff to come forward and provide information, I'll emphasize the word again, information on a local option. Again, I think there's confusion with the staffing changes that are being made in the co-occurrence area relative to the local option and staffing that would address some of the mental health issues of people in the criminal justice system. So could you provide information on how that funding will occur and what type of support might be offered if the bond measure, local option levy passes?
Sure, I'd be glad to. Curtis Landers, Lincoln County Sheriff. And I've been seeing it seems like there's been comments tying the layoffs in behavioral health to the ballot measure and that we have, and it's, it probably couldn't be further from the truth of what is really happening. I mean, the ballot measure is really addressing the inmate population, and we have in the ballot measure there's a dedicated inmate counselor to add to the current inmate counselor we have right now. And there is a definite need for that because we are experiencing that at any given time out of 161 inmates in our jail that 30% of them have some sort of mental illness, and that's not even considering the addictions. That came from our current inmate counselor, Dennis Buckmaster. He's not able to address the needs of those individuals adequately to really get them out of jail quicker. And that's kind of the bottom line is what we're trying to do with the whole package. I've talked about being an enforcement component, a prevention component, a programming component, and an education component with it. And, it's not just tied to the jail also. It's got an enforcement where we're wanting to restore 24/7 patrol coverage for all the county. And I've talked about how that relates to the fact that we serve 25,000 population roughly in this county, and we don't have 24/7 coverage to do that. And we already, because of the geography we have to cover, already at a disadvantage compared to the cities. I've mentioned that before, and people have I've commented on that. But as it relates to the jail, there is a definite need, again, to address the circumstances one-on-one. Our current inmate counselor is while he addresses the more severe needs and the crisis situations one-on-one, most of his work is now on group counseling rather than one-on-one counseling. And so he's not capable of addressing whatever that the barrier is for that person to get them again out of jail, and they end up spending more time in jail than they should. And when I say they, I'm talking about someone with mental illness and specifically severe mental illness. And we know that if we can get another inmate counsel in there to establish more one-on-one contact with the inmates, that we'll be able to address that. And then take that even further, pretrial justice, which is something that's going on nationwide. It's going on locally within our state. It's a program that I've learned, and with several others from our community, includes Judge Bockhart, DA Michelle Branham, Community Justice Director Susie Gonzalez, Defense Attorney Guy Greco. We went to a 2.5-day conference and a course on this. This is really the future of where we need to be to address the inmate population, and that's looking at the addictions and mental illness are top priority for that, because what we're seeing is individuals that get arrested, the more time they spend in jail, the chance of them reoffending when they get out significantly goes up. And I'm not talking about 6 months or a year. I'm talking that starts at day one. And so we know that if we can address their needs and address their barriers right at the beginning instead of waiting till the end, we can more effectively manage our inmate population so that we're not always overcrowded and having to force release inmates back in the community that are not ready, that have not served out their sentence, and don't have a proper monitoring component to it to make sure that they are complying with the restrictions and that are placed on them. But it gets people to be successful out there while they're waiting for the trial, and not in this revolving door that we're seeing that's been going on for years. This isn't something that just crept up on us. This is something that's been building for years and years and years. And the thing is that we realize that we cannot arrest ourselves out of this problem. The state realizes that. That's why justice reinvestment funding has been passed down to counties to achieve the things that they've been doing. But the pretrial component that we want to establish with this funding is essential to addressing needs with people with mental health. But it is also working in partnership with behavioral health, too. I'm not going to say it's completely separated, but and I wish Rebecca was here to hear this. The fact is that we work in partnership with this. I was saddened to hear about the layoffs too, knowing what's occurring, and know that there is a definite need. But I also understand that we have to manage our budgets and we have to effectively do that. I have full confidence though that with Rebecca and her team, what she's trying to do, we'll rebuild and we're going to even be better. And with the passage of this measure, we will even be more effective to address those needs.
If I can clarify, I think one of the big differences is, and correct me if I'm wrong, the issue in the co-occurrence area is that we've got staff that the funding doesn't support because there's not the caseload to get the reimbursements. But if the local option passes, that will create the stable funding that will then enable the hiring of the counselors in the corrections area.
Specifically in the jail to
right.
deal with the inmate
right.
population,
so
yes.
The local option will provide the funding that isn't available for the co-occurrence counselors based on the present volumes.
Correct.
Mr. Chair, and if I could add something to that point you just made, that because it's something I've heard from the public, some people have said, well, why can't some of these co-occurring program counselors go into the jail and provide services? And in a and it would be great if that was possible, but unfortunately, when you're on Medicaid or private insurance, once you're in custody, your benefits are turned off. Correct. Oregon is what's called a suspension state. At least we're not among the states where if you're taken into custody, you're just kicked off and then have to reapply for Medicaid once you get out. But once you're in custody in our jail or other jails or prisons, your, you know, in the case of the Lincoln County Jail, your care is on the taxpayer's dime. It becomes part of the sheriff's budget, correct?
Correct. And besides the general fund, we don't have any of that funding coming in to address those needs that we that are there and have you know, that we could have need somebody for. That's why we want to go to the voters to achieve this, this solution for them while people are in jail. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for that clarification and information. I appreciate it. Last thing I'll report is I have been appointed to the Maritime Sector Strategy Committee by the governor.
Yay!
That took forever.
That did take a while.
Better late than never.
Yep.
So I got that news yesterday.
Congratulations.
All right. Anything else on commissioners? All right. Next item is constituent input. And we ask any individual that would like to address the Board of Commissioners to come forward. Please limit your comments to no more than 5 minutes. And it looks like we have one individual. Please, we have others. For the record, introduce yourselves. And
good morning, Commissioners. My name is Steve Sparks, and I came this morning as volunteering to come in and speak to you and to support Rebecca Austin in the work that's cut out for us. And the one thing that she said that's a good segue to what we are doing in the county right now with respect to the Stepping Up initiative is sustainability. And as your project consultant for almost 2 years now, we've been intimately involved in looking at the collaborations and partners that are connected with capacity building and sustainability. And we're well along the way to help with this challenge, because what the Stepping Up Initiative research showed us is that we're very weak in the community treatment and recovery services that are available. Other counties for years have had a lot stronger infrastructure to support the institutions. And at the center of the Stepping Up Initiative, as you know, is to have the right kind of services in the community so we divert folks from the jail. I serve on the Sheriff's Community Advisory Group and also the Mental Health Advisory Committee. So I have some insight on the bigger picture of what's going on here. The key to a lot of the community support that we're providing right now is, community treatment and recovery, is the peer support business model that's certified by the OHA, Oregon Health Authority, and also IHNCCO. So there's diversified funding opportunities out there that we have not been able to take advantage of that we're now looking at. Rebecca also brought up the potential for pilot programs. There's a pilot program proposal that's being put together right now. Chance, our local nonprofit who is helping us there along with the community services consortium, and we might be able to get on that. But we have some very strong momentum right now to build capacity in Lincoln County that matches up with a lot of the metrics that we're talking about. Will give us an opportunity for diversified funding. The sheriff's measure 21-186 is part of that. So if you think about it, a bottom line is that we can't continue as a community to put all this pressure on our institutions, including the jail and health and human services, and that's why we're in trouble right now, because we have not had a strategic plan, a business and finance metrics to work with, and that's what we're building toward. And it's not like it's complicated, but we do have templates to work with. And I came in early this morning, and Rebecca came in right after me, and you know what was great about that? her smile. Her smile. That's very refreshing, and it's very welcoming. It's very warm. She has a business background, which I'm delighted with. That's where I come from. And I think we're on our way to executing some solutions that are on the table right now. I mean, we're not lost in the weeds here. We have a plan. We can execute. And I'm just really happy that Rebecca is on board with that, and I see a bright future for Lincoln County. I'm delighted to be able to work with Sheriff Landers and his team. We have an excellent organization there, so we have a team. I call it the A team.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, anyone else? I believe a gentleman in the front there.
Thank you. Good to see you all. Thank you for giving me this time. Hi, Bill. Hi, Terry. So, I'm here to ask for
Your Robert, you do need to introduce yourself.
My name is Robert Rubin. I live in Waldport. I'm here to ask for your help before we go to the Land Use Board to appeal the recent Lincoln County Planning Commission, who endorsed the decision of the Planning Department Director to not regulate Ekman Creek Quarry's Kaufman Crushing. They told me they had to. They dropped Mr. Belmont's name. They told me to go to Luba. People have told me I should come to you, our county commissioners, before taking, filing our Luba appeal and our citizen-initiated enforcement order. Ekman Creek Quarries, Kaufman Crushing, is a surface mining and rock crushing business. They presently have no permission to operate in Lincoln County. They have no land use permission, conditional or not. They have no regulated days or hours of operation. This includes Saturdays and Sundays, 7 days a week. The Planning Department claims this quarry is shielded or protected from land use laws, rules, and statutes by a grandfather clause protection. Specifically, and if I may present you each with copies so you can actually see. Didn't bring one for you. The last page has the actual statute that the Planning Department is referring to. So the director wrote a letter of facts and findings, specifically LCC 1605.3. In the case of a use existing prior to February 12, 1974, and classified in this chapter as a conditional use or non-conforming use, change in use or in lot area or an alteration of structure shall conform with the requirements for conditional use. Okay, so in the letter, the director uses a 1972 or 1973 photo. Now, in 1989, 21.9 acres were added on to the lot. The adjacent tax lot, 801 T14SR11.
I want to ask a question, Council. If this goes to Luba, is this considered ex parte contact?
It could be, yes.
And that means that we can't hear this. Is that correct?
Technically, you know, obviously we have to make the initial decision of whether or not there's an appeal right to the Board of Commissioners. I need to advise you on that particular question. If there's no appeal right, then there's no ex parte contact. Robert's remedy would be to go to Luba on this. If there is an appeal, yes, this would be an ex parte contact. This could potentially be. The problem we run into is you have a right as a constituent to come and do public input here. If we end up doing something before the Board of Commissioners, we'll have to declare the ex parte contact and provide all the information, including this, to the parties.
Okay, then we can listen.
Well, you know, technically, I think that what you've got is you've got a request here to say, is there a right of appeal to the Board of Commissioners? I think what you need is advice from counsel, which I have to give you separately. So I'm not going to do it from here.
Right. So you would review, come back to us with a yes or no.
Yes.
If your answer is no, then Mr. Rubin would take the appeal directly to Luba.
Yes.
If the answer is yes, there would be a hearing before us. Mr. Rubin, anybody else
concerned. We have an opportunity at that hearing to present all the arguments if you want to.
The usual quasi-judicial judicial hearing.
We've I don't normally make contacts, but here's the situation. We'll later, may, depending on what happens, be the judges
right.
in this case. And we have to be careful of this because of the ex parte contact laws.
Okay, so, I don't understand the ex parte. I'm not an attorney.
It's basically almost like a judicial proceeding.
Let's let Wayne do it.
That's fine.
Let's ask Wayne to
provide. Ex parte means that if you're going to have a hearing on a matter which is considered, land use laws considered these kinds of things are quasi-judicial. It's like sitting in front of the judge. The judge has to have all the parties that are necessary for this particular decision sitting here and listening to what's being presented. If you allow one to do a presentation without the others present, then that's an ex parte contact, and that could lead to some problems with the decision. So, you know, you're talking about the particulars. What you've done now is at least raised the question of whether or not there's an appeal right to the Board of Commissioners, and that needs to be determined by them first, and then you can come talk about the merits of your case, if, you know, either here or before the Land Use Board of Appeals.
Okay, so I shouldn't say anything else to you at
no,
this
I think
point.
You put this at issue. We know that we've got an issue here.
Right.
And okay.
Feel free. So
am I allowed to say?
You got more time.
There's one critical thing in the letter. Can I speak about that? That the director did not. He quotes the statute, but then he doesn't write the statute in his letter. He cuts and pastes from other parts, making our argument that they increased the size. My attorney isn't here. My
That's
attorneys
fine.
Are in the valley.
That's fine.
So I don't know if I should. I don't want any. All of this stuff has been
That's
out there.
I don't know either in this case, and I just.
This is difficult, and it's usually because there's prescribed procedures for when you appeal, and you move it up the ladder here. And this is a question. It's a fundamental question of whether there's a right to appeal to the Board of Commissioners, which we need to address first. So we'll address that. If we stop it now. You know, and we're going to still have to, at this point, you're going to have to declare if there's a hearing before the board, you've had an ex parte contact.
Yeah.
So we've got that issue.
So I guess I would caution you that certainly as an individual, you have the right to come and address the Board of Commissioners.
Right.
We certainly aren't trying to say that you don't. But it might be in your best interest to, now having raised that issue,
right.
let us work with our legal counsel to get an opinion. And then, again, we're look out for your best interests.
Right, and I appreciate that. So where does that leave me with my 21 days to appeal the decision?
I can't advise you. What I would suggest is you talk to an attorney. You say you've got attorneys in the valley. I would talk.
Yeah, we're starting the Luber appeal, and we're starting a citizen-initiated enforcement order against the county.
And that's something you need to talk to your private attorneys about.
Okay, so when will you make this decision on whether you will listen to me? Well, because I heard a lot of buzzwords today.
Just for clarification, we're willing to listen to you now, but we're saying it may not be in your best interest.
Right, and I appreciate that. Okay.
Yeah, since it's a potential case.
Right.
And
right.
We have to act as a judge.
So how will I hear about this decision, and when will I know whether I'm coming back here or filing the LUBA?
Again, I would suggest you talk to your attorneys and they can call me and I'll discuss it with them if they want to discuss the procedures.
Okay.
That would work. And then,
Sorry to bring it
up in the middle.
No,
right?
It's a good
idea.
No,
I thought getting into the case.
And again, we're trying to act in your best interest.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Really are.
Protect your rights.
Okay. I appreciate it.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Yep.
All right. Thank you. Anyone else wish to address the Board of Commissioners? Welcome, and we know you, but please introduce yourself for the record.
So for the record, David Allen, resident of Newport. I just wanted to follow up on some of the comments that Commissioner Thompson and Wayne Belmont provided with respect to the Ocean Policy Advisory Council meeting last week and the court opinion that was issued. As you know, I was the attorney representing the petitioners on that case. I wasn't planning on speaking this morning. In fact, I spoke with Wayne earlier this morning and kind of went over some of the next steps forward. And Wayne and Commissioner Thompson did a nice job of providing that overview and the next steps forward. But I thought I'd come just to say one thing. This was probably one of the last times I'll be here speaking on this particular issue because it's going to be moving forward through the OPEC and the LCDC process. So what I want to say was Thank you, Wayne Belmont, on behalf of the petitioners and the Coastal Counties for all the work that you did on the amicus brief and in working with me on behalf of petitioners in moving this process forward. And I just wanted to acknowledge the work you did over and above the work you do as county council. I know you spent some weekends working on this issue. We talked over the weekend many times, and I just think I just wanted to put it on the record that I really, personally, I really appreciate all the work you did on this issue, not only in helping our process move forward with respect to our petition for judicial review, but also what you did on behalf of not just Lincoln County, but all the coastal counties. So thank you, Wayne, and I really appreciate it.
Thank you, David. Thank you, David. Anyone else wish to address the Board of Commissioners at this time? All right. Seeing no one come forward, there is no executive session. The next meeting of the Board of Commissioners will be on Wednesday, May 9th at 9:30 a.m. right here in the Board of Commissioners room, 108 here in the courthouse. And with that, we're adjourned.